Şansaglam, İstanbul.
Seyyed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Şahanabad, Indian Administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
As the U.S. is sending cluster bombs to Ukraine, the deadly legacy of these destructive U.S. weapons continues to take its toll on civilians in other countries, including Afghanistan. According to Human Rights Watch, the U.S. dropped more than 1,200 cluster bombs containing tens of thousands of bombless in Afghanistan in the first 3 years of its invasion of the country. As a result, hundreds of Afghan people were killed, wounded, or maimed forever.
It was 10 p.m. when bombardment started on our house. I was targeted with an American bomb while fleeing the bombardment. I lost my feet and my hand was injured. Since then, I have been living a terrible life.
The Taliban's official for martyrs and disabled affairs also says the U.S. war on Afghanistan has created many victims, especially from cluster bombs.
Most martyrs, disabled and maimed people registered by our administration are harmed by the U.S. indiscriminate strikes and cluster bombs. The U.S. used to claim they were targeting Taliban fighters, but their destructive war machines destroyed an entire village and left no civilian unharmed.
Military experts have warned that unexploded cluster bombs across Afghanistan are still posing a serious threat to the lives of innocent people, including school children, shepherds, and farmers.
War was ongoing in all 34 provinces of Afghanistan. Cluster bombs were dropped by NATO and American forces in most places. I'm sure that they're not cleared yet, especially in the outskirts of the cities, mountainous in conflict areas. They pose a serious threat to civilians there. International bodies and NGOs as well as the Taliban should solve the problem as soon as possible.
Afghan people urge the international community to prevent the use of cluster bombs globally and hold the U.S. accountable for their war crimes in Afghanistan. The U.S. left Afghanistan 2 years ago, but its unexploded bombs are still here, posing threat to the lives of innocent people. Afghans are calling for justice and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Is GDP a real indicator of economic growth of a given nation? Many economists agree that although the measure is a rough and ready instrument to assess the size of economy of a given country, it is not designed to estimate welfare or the well-being of its citizens. However, most governments resort to broadcasting their growing GDP to reassure domestic and international markets. Italy's current executive makes no exception. Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has, on several occasions, stressed that GDP growth is a measure of success for her predecessor Mario Draghi and her government.
Our capacity for post-pandemic recovery is therefore all to see. Today, the Italian economy is growing beyond expectations, with an upward forecast estimate of GDP of more than 1.2% in 2023.
Based on the final data for 2022, I'm using the 2023 projections from the latest OECD Economic Outlook, Italy is expected to achieve the strongest economic growth among G7 countries in the 2023 period, with a 5% increase in GDP over 2 years. The situation on the ground is very much different. Inflation in Italy has risen remarkably from mid-2021, passing the 12% mark last year. Over one in four people in the country were at risk of poverty or social exclusion in 2022, according to a latest report by the National Bureau of Statistics, Istat. Furthermore, just under 25% of Italians between the ages of 15 and 29 are at risk of becoming poor, compared to an EU average of around 20%.
As for Italy's crisis, wealth distribution in the country has never been so uneven, with an increasing number of workers practically falling into a state of slavery. The decision by the ECB to raise interest rates to counter high inflation has only aggravated the situation. This way, the payments on variable rate mortgages have practically doubled for a large number of Italian households.
Also, data by charity Oxfam shows the concentration of wealth in Italy has considerably increased by the end of 2021. the wealth of the richest 5% of Italians, owner of over 40% of national wealth, was higher than the stock of wealth held by the poorest 80%.
The picture is the same across the whole of Europe too. Data from the European Statistical Agency Eurostat shows the gulf between rich and the poor has become tragically more pronounced also in the old continent over the past years. Max Civili, Rome.
Iraqi Prime Minister Mohammed al-Sudani has arrived in Damascus, where he was received in an official welcoming ceremony by Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. The two leaders held talks discussing bilateral relations and means of enhancing them, especially in trade exchange, transport and industry, as well as in the political field and joint efforts in fighting terror and securing their shared 600-kilometer border from security threats. Assad said this visit is an opportunity to establish institutional relations and boost bilateral cooperation. The Iraqi top official said the Iraqi people are proud of Syrians' steadfastness. The two sides held a press conference underlining the importance of collaboration to address joint challenges such as terror, drug smuggling, and water shortages.
There are challenges we face directly, mainly terrorism and cooperation in countering it. Terrorism is active due to Western support, using it as a tool to target countries adhering to its independence and national interests. Some regional countries also supported terrorism. The biggest challenge is the Syrian and Iraqi people being deprived of their share of the Euphrates water, which results in thirst, hunger, and illnesses. We also have challenges on drugs, which can destroy societies.
Assad noted that economic ties will be the focus of future discussions with the aim of overcoming the economic siege on Syria. He praised Iraq for its years-long support for Syria during the war. Al-Sudani reiterated his country's support for Syria's unity, referring to the necessity of solving the refugee situation.
Iraq's support for Syria's sovereignty and the government's control of all its territories is a matter of interest to Iraqi national security. The Syrian and Iraqi blood shed together portrays the clearest images of relations between both countries. The biggest joint challenges today are security and economy. We need more coordination. Today, we are creating mechanisms for such coordination.
Al-Sudani said Syria cannot be left alone in facing difficulties and called for lifting the unjust Western sanctions on the Arab country. He denounced the Israeli occupation of Arab lands, as well as the regime's aggressions on Syria and Lebanon. The Iraqi official is accompanied by ministers of foreign affairs and trade, as well as the deputy chief of joint operations in Iraq. The Iraqi prime minister's visit comes at a crucial time in which both countries are in a desperate need for increasing economic cooperation to overcome difficulties resulting from wars. Both states have for long suffered from Daesh terrorism, and high-level talks can strengthen joint efforts for countering terror. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
On Thursday, tens of thousands of rail workers in Italy staged a day-long walkout over pay and safety at work, hampering public transportation services and tourists' access to their destinations. The strike action, called by the three largest trade unions, CGL, CISL and UIL, caused cancellations and delays to national and regional trains at the peak of the country's booming high tourist season. Italy, like much of Europe, is suffering from high inflation and stagnant economic growth, and unions are protesting against low wages, especially in relation to the ongoing increase in the cost of living.
Today's action revolves around two issues. We demand an adjustment of the collective pay agreements for our sector and more hiring to ease pressure on employees and their unsustainable workloads. Furthermore, more investments on railway maintenance are needed. Last-minute negotiations with the Transport Ministry failed on Tuesday. The government showed up too late.
Also, air transport workers are set to down tools on Saturday despite Transport Minister Matteo Salvini's attempts to persuade unions to call off the strikes.
This new industrial action, the latest in a long line of transport strikes, is widely expected to be more disruptive than most, which are generally only backed by one or two major unions. Commuters are once again facing delays and cancellations,
they are saying they are at the end of their rope.
Disruptions keep affecting us. It's not just about tourists. Commuters are those who are bearing the brunt for the mismanagement of our public transport system. This way, they force people to resort to their cars.
Workers' wages in Italy are excessively low. I understand those who are staging the strike. As a result, commuters are left to face the music.
About 90% of rail transport sector workers joined the strike called by CGL, CISL and WIL unions. Even high-speed lines that are usually guaranteed during Italy's frequent work stoppages were affected. Max Civili, Rome.
A familiar sight as the summer of strikes and disruptions in England rolls on. While some health workers have settled, junior doctors, who form 40% of the workforce in the National Health Service here, are still locked in a bitter war of words with the government. They say the request of a 35% pay rise is an opening offer and accuse the government of negotiating in bad faith. And while the deadlock continues, it's the patients who are paying the price, as hundreds of thousands of appointments and operations are postponed, despite Prime Minister Rishi Sunak setting cutting the NHS waiting list, now at more than 7 million, as a top priority.
The government argues that any pay rises funded through borrowing for these junior doctors or others in the public sector risk fueling the inflation that's highest among the G7 advanced economies. But not everyone agrees with that.
The cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it.
As the strike got underway, an announcement by the Prime Minister saying his government's offer for pay rises was the last such offer and that there would be no more negotiations with the unions. But with the tens of thousands of nurses and doctors having quit last year, the strikers say the pay rises are needed to keep them in the profession.
People are leaving the profession and we're losing staff. They're going across to Australia, New Zealand, America to get paid more money. But also within the UK, they're taking on more private work, equivalent private work.
This month, we'll also see disruption on the railways as an overtime ban for train drivers comes into force and as staff walk off altogether yet again. For the time being, disputes dragging on, plenty of problems for the government, few simple solutions. Saidpur is up, London.
Common wound among the Iranian and Japanese nation. Following the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Sardash became the third city to endure an attack by a weapon of mass destruction. Sardash, the first city to suffer a chemical attack, hosted a Japanese diplomatic delegation to commemorate the victims of this assault. According to Shiva, the wife of one of the victims of Sardash, her husband is still suffering from the consequences of the attack that occurred 36 years ago.
Because of the sanctions, I can't get the appropriate medicine for my husband. He has been suffering from chemo for a long time.
36 years ago, Western countries, including the United States, England, and Germany, provided Iraqi dictator Saddam with chemical weapons, which he used on Iranian people. This action has not been condemned by any human rights body in the world. Mr. Murakami from the Japanese delegation emphasized the importance of telling the world about the crimes that took place in Sardash, saying this was the reason for their visit to the town.
I think it is important for the world to get to know about what happened in Sardash some 30, 40 years ago. So I think it's very important for me to really come visit this place.
The international community has turned a blind eye on this brutal chemical attack in the last 36 years. We can hope such meetings and gatherings can pave the way to raise the voice of the victims of this brutal attack. Farzan Ashurium, Sardash.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol traveled to Vilnius, Lithuania to participate in his second NATO summit as he seeks the bloc's support in deterring North Korea.
As Secretary General Stoltenberg has mentioned, we are in the situation where the security in the Atlantic cannot be separated from the security in the Indo-Pacific region.
NATO has requested South Korea send military aid to Ukraine, and while Seoul has restricted its assistance to non-lethal aid, NATO maintains interest in South Korea taking a greater role in the pact.
Nuclear and missile programs of North Korea, this affects all NATO allies and underlines the importance of all those who believe in the rules-based order to stand together.
South Korea signed an 11-point cooperation agreement with NATO on the first day of the Vilnius summit. South Korea's President Yoon has sought to strengthen the country's alliance with the United States since coming to office in May of 2022. But now his efforts to boost defense ties and up the pressure on North Korea take on new dimensions with South Korea's cooperation agreement with NATO. However, in South Korea, the Yoon government's moves to court NATO membership draw concern.
As NATO's expansion and military progress are strengthened, and the U.S. intention to build a global alliance is strengthened, the confrontation structure of the new Cold War, where confrontations and crises take place on a daily basis, will be strengthened. Also, peace in Asia, the Pacific region, and the Korean Peninsula in Northeast Asia will be destroyed.
North Korea, meanwhile, launched a ballistic missile on the second day of the NATO summit. Tensions have been high, with the U.S. and South Korea holding large-scale military drills and planning to again soon deploy a U.S. nuclear submarine to South Korea. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Seventeen years have passed since Israel launched its biggest full-scale war against Lebanon. Apart from the 1982 invasion, the Israeli Air Force bombarded the infrastructure of Lebanon, threw cluster munitions in most of southern Lebanon, and killed over 1,200 people. The town of Bint Ishbael witnessed some of the most fierce fighting during the 2006 war. This market was turned to rubble, yet that was a cost the people of Lebanon were ready to pay, if it meant that Israel would be deterred from launching another act of aggression. The fighting here turned to hand-to-hand combat at times, and the Israelis were still incapable of dislodging Hezbollah, while resistance rockets increased. Strategy experts believe that before 2006, Hezbollah's main goal was a strategy of defense. Yet the fighting capabilities of the resistance has reached an extent where launching a preemptive war against the Israelis is plausible. Israel's internal investigations into the July war proved that it was a failed mission for the regime. Yet Hezbollah's military presence remains intact and its popular support stronger than ever before. The 2006 July war gave birth to a new equilibrium in the conflict between Lebanon and Israel, and it proved that Hezbollah was not to be taken lightly. Israel's worst fear now is that any wrong move could fight Hezbollah in the Galilee region. Maryam Saleh, Marun Ras, South Lebanon.
The wheels of the British economy are turning, but not fast enough. And the state of the job market is one indicator. The UK's Office for National Statistics says the unemployment rate jumped to 4% in the 3 months to May this year, up from 3.8% previously, driven by wage rises and by people out of work for up to 12 months.
Well, employment levels are high, but the trouble with Britain is we got less people working than pre-COVID. So we got record levels in employment. We're not far off the record levels. But the number of people in jobs has gone down because we've got this sort of 600,000 to 900,000 people seem to have disappeared from the workforce.
Finance Minister Jeremy Hunt has put getting Britons back into work at the heart of his plan for economic growth. Yet more than 1 million people are still unemployed. Let's see how the UK economy compares with other advanced economies. The Paris-based Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, says year-on-year inflation in the group of seven wealthy nations fell to 4.6% in May this year, down from 5.4% in April, reaching its lowest level since September 2021, making the UK the only country in the G7 where inflation is at 8.7%.
Well, The cause of inflation is not the workers asking for wage rises. It's the printing of money. You see, central banks want to blame everybody but themselves. They printed the money. The US did it, the UK did it, the Europeans did it. But, of course, Britain has the additional problem of Brexit, and that has pushed up inflation costs across the economy. It's the only explanation for the big differential.
The Bank of England, whose job it is to control inflation, has responded with increasing the interest rate 13 times so far, with more interest rate rises on the horizon. That has seen mortgage rates soar, making repayments more difficult for homeowners, many of whom have seen their salaries squeezed by inflation, setting off a tidal wave of public sector strikes over the past year.
The government here has promised labor market reforms, including expanding free childcare next year, hoping to encourage more and more people to go back to work and fill in those hundreds of thousands of vacancies that it says are fueling inflation. But the fact remains that the rate of economic growth and inflation in the UK remain particularly bad compared to similar economies. Saeed Borizov, London.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Wheat prices are soaring once again. This as Russia has announced that it will not renew a UN brokered deal that was agreed upon in July of 2022. The agreement was supposed to help stabilize wheat prices after they started rising following the beginning of the Russian-Ukraine conflict. In the agreement, Russia had allowed Ukrainian wheat to be exported via the Black Sea without targeting its ships. However, Russia says that though it abided by its part of the deal, others did not abide by their end of the bargain. Thus, according to Moscow, there will be no deal until Russia's demands are also met. Well, we're going to take a look at all of this on this Spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. And out of Bristol, historian, investigative journalist, and a former BBC employee, Tony Gosling, thank you both for being with me. Well, let me start this off in New York. And Andres, how important do you see this Black Sea Initiative?
It's very important for the entire world. You mentioned the grain prices earlier. We know that when this deal was brokered the first time, grain prices dropped 20% almost immediately. And it is this unilateral action happening by the aggressor state to Ukraine's north, cutting off this food in contravention of the agreements made with Turkey. Turkey, which is willing to send ships into the Black Sea to protect those grain ships. At the beginning of this full-fledged aggression in February of 2022, we had full silos in Ukraine, full silos of last year's wheat ready to go out, and it was allowed to rot there, or some places were actually being targeted by Russia. So this is a boon for the rest of the world when the deal was signed, a bad deal for the rest of the world when Russia pulled out.
Your take, Tony, your perspective of why you think Russia has pulled out of the deal.
Well, it's interesting to hear my colleague there talk about Russia as the aggressor state, because maybe he can't remember back in 1991 with the fall of the Soviet Union. It is that the United States and NATO promised faithfully that they wouldn't move any of their troops up to the border. They wouldn't take advantage of the fact that these countries were now independent to colonize them, to bring them into NATO. And of course, that's exactly what's happened. And the Russians are understandably concerned that NATO is advancing right up to their borders, rather like the Soviet Union, you could argue, did when they started putting missiles into Cuba back in the 1960s, advancing up to the United States border. So this is not an aggressive act by the Russians. It's a defensive act. And, of course, anyone that looks into what's been going on in Ukraine will know that the Russians moved in February last year, in 2022, because the Ukrainian army was about to attack the Donbass and break the Minsk agreement. This is this Russian-speaking area in the southeast of Ukraine. But if you're looking at what's been going on with grain, I think, you know, even if you're looking at negotiations in the world of the Olympics, in sport, in almost every field, including things like chemical weapons, many of these international bodies are being basically occupied and controlled now by the NATO bloc. And the main reason that there's been problems with this grain shipment, it seems to me, is because of the massive insurance that many of the ship owners are now having to pay. They believe that at any time this war could escalate and the ships carrying the grain. So I think, could be blown up in the sea. So I think there needs to be obviously some kind of plan B, where this grain, of course, could be moved around quite efficiently and quite effectively by other means, for example, by train around the world. Ship is the cheapest way of doing it. But if the West is not prepared to do honest deals with the Russians, then I'm afraid, of course, the Russians are just simply going to have to pull out of the deal.
Hmm. What about that, Andrea? You heard what Tony said. If the West is not ready to deal with Russia honestly, the Russian side is saying that with this agreement, they kept their side of the agreement, but the other side did not keep their side of the agreement. Your take on that?
I think there's report after report laying lie to that statement. Obviously, I'm, as most everybody here, are against wars that are launched without any precept. The war, just like the Iraq war, being launched on the idea that there might be weapons of mass destruction. Same thing here, as a preemptive war to possibly have some NATO troops in Ukraine. I believe that's the proposition. Nobody here believes in this. War should not be preemptive. If an aggressor state, like the aggressor state to Ukraine's north, begins a war, it is every country's right to defend itself from that. In terms of the lies being given, the very beginning of this full-fledged aggression in February 22 was when Russia held illegally, I must add, but Russia controlled the Security Council for the month of February and denied repeatedly that it was launching a war, in contravention of almost every military analyst around the world. And then when it launched the war, it continued to say that it wasn't launching a war, up until President Putin released a video statement saying that, yes, he's indeed launching a preemptive war against Ukraine. Again, you have to look at report after report after report. There was a report issued just this month about children in war zones being affected by Russia, the effect on elderly in Ukraine by the aggressor state of Russia. So everything that Russia is saying, if it's asking to be taken at face value, it shouldn't be ripping up peace agreements. It shouldn't be ripping up any of four international agreements that it did when it invaded Ukraine. So it's on the aggressor state to come back into the fold of international agreement.
Tony, your take on this whole agreement, because, again, we're going to go back to what Russia is saying. It's saying that one of the agreements, the other side was supposed to actually lift the sanctions and allow Russia to export food and fertilizer, also to help with a major agricultural lender with a SWIFT payment system, giving them the okay in order to help with the problems that they have in insuring Russian cargo. The Russians are saying that none of these agreements were fulfilled. Thus, they kept the agreement for 1 year, but now have decided to cancel on it. Your take on what Moscow is saying?
Well, it's very similar to what happened with the Minsk agreement, because the Ukraine and the West simply didn't keep to that. This is when there was supposed to be a ceasefire in the Donbass. What happened was, and this is back in 2014-2015, after the Victoria Nuland's coup in Kiev, and at that point there was an agreement signed in Minsk, and the Ukrainians simply didn't keep to it. They kept shelling into the Donbass, and about 15,000 4,000 people, we're not talking about soldiers here, we're talking about mostly civilians, died during that period. So, you know, I don't think, and also, of course, when Zelensky was first elected, he was elected on a platform of actually stopping this conflict in the Donbass. Then the Ukrainian Nazis approached him after he was elected and threatened to kill him if he stopped the aggression in the Donbass. And so, of course, he didn't do that. And then we had the war breakout. So I think we need to just understand that you can only actually untangle a war like this if you start to face the facts and reality about who the aggressors are. And the Russians quite clearly are now fighting not just Ukraine, but they're fighting NATO. This morning we had the attack on the Kerch Bridge. Both of the directions of the road part of that bridge blown up. Now, that wasn't just Ukraine on its own. Much of the equipment that's being used in attacks like this, and, of course, almost all of the satellite imagery and the electronic warfare side of these things is supplied by NATO. So NATO is massively engaged in this conflict in Ukraine, and the Russians know that. And I think what we're going to see is this will just simply continue. Now, there are signs here in the UK that many of our senior people at the Foreign Office and the Ministry of Defence are recognising that if we carry on this course, supporting this Ukraine-Russia conflict, that Britain will start to get embroiled in a war with Russia. Obviously, they can see the dangers of that. Many of the army generals here in Britain are telling them that we don't want a war with Russia because we certainly couldn't win it. And also it would mean a massive number of casualties, both of our soldiers and of possibly civilians here in the UK. So we've seen this weekend Ben Wallace announce, this is the British Defence Secretary, who was slated to become the new Secretary General of NATO, actually resign, saying, well, he hasn't actually resigned now. He's going to be resigning in a few weeks' time. So he's had enough, basically. He's saying, look, and he's warning, he's saying, look, the way we're heading now, we could be at war with Russia or with China by the year 2030. And so he's stepping away from it. He's saying, I want nothing more to do either with NATO or with this policy. And we've seen exactly the same thing happening with Dominic Raab, the former foreign secretary, a year or so ago, when there was a British warship that came into the waters, tried to provoke the Russians. Dominic Raab spoke against it, and he was then booted out of government. We've also seen, of course, Boris Johnson resign recently. So there are many people in the British Conservative ruling party who are really throwing hands and saying, we want nothing more to do with this NATO policy. And they're quite right to do that, I think.
Well, your take on that, Andre, it just seems that this situation is escalating more and more each day. And it doesn't seem that talks it doesn't seem like either side are talking to each other. I mean, your take on where this is going, it just seems to be getting worse and worse in general, the whole conflict. Your take.
I don't know what you mean by worse and worse. I do know that thanks to the Alliance of Nations who are supporting freedom and democracy, Ukraine has received an incremental slate of weapons, more munitions by the month, and that has helped Ukraine gain kilometers of territory in the last week, over 18 square kilometers, but it's been kilometers a day since they started coming and liberating the area that Russia has occupied for many months now. Much of that area will have to be demined. We're talking about 20% to 30% of a country that is full of landmines. Many serious war crimes happening, whether you're talking about the stealing of children, the sexual violence against women as old as 82 or children as young as 4. This is all happening on Ukrainian territory. So I return again to the condemnation of preemptive wars, which I think we all agree. We all agree also that a country has a right to defend itself. And Russia right now, to return to your initial topic, Russia right now is threatening the rest of the world by, again, threatening international food supplies. Ukraine supplied the bulk of food, the bulk of grain, to many Middle Eastern, North African, and South Asian countries. That lack of grain, if the prices were to go up and make it unfeasible for those countries to get basic grain supplies, could destabilize some governments, and that would threaten war in other parts of the world, which is exactly what the United Nations does not want to happen, and why we're going to see a press conference at the United Nations in about half hour's time.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
What about that? With this agreement, that the grain agreement, why do you think that, from what Moscow is saying, that the other side have not kept their side of it? If they did not want the situation to deteriorate, and of course the situation with increased prices and also just hunger and poverty in general increasing, so why wouldn't they keep their side of the deal?
Well, the West won't keep its side of the deal for the same reason as Zelensky didn't keep his side of the deal in Minsk. It's because, actually, they want a war. I mean, the West now, as we've seen with places like Syria and Iraq, they like these long, long wars, what George Orwell framed as the endless war, that actually... what it does is it gives a fantastic amount of money to the arms industry. So the arms industry is constantly supplying, replenishing, and you end up with a country like Britain, which is really not producing it very much at all, except war expertise. And and of course, the United States is now supplying most of Europe with its weaponry. And so they like these endless wars. It keeps up a kind of bullying pressure on Russia, on China, on Iran and other countries. And that's the main object, I think, of the failure of the West to keep to any of these agreements. And I remember Putin saying around about 3 or 4 years ago, he said that the United States is not deal ready. Now, this means that when they're sitting down at the table negotiating, they're constantly thinking, well, how long is this deal going to last? And is there any point in really signing the deal? And, of course, that's what's happened today with the grain deal, because the West has simply not done what they said they would do. And, for example, reinstitute the SWIFT payment system to drop many of the sanctions against Russia. And they just haven't done it. So what's the point in signing a deal with people who constantly welch on the deal? So I think really the West is on this kind of death trip in a way, in that they are completely obsessed with undermining Putin, undermining Russia, so that they can open up Russian markets and Russian raw materials for them to devour. And that is actually what's really motivating this, is we've got these two separate systems. We've got democracies in the East, obviously not in China, but certainly in Russia. And in the West, we don't have, I mean, certainly, I just had my colleague talking about the Alliance of Democracies. There's no democracy whatsoever in Ukraine. It's a dictatorship with no political activity opposing the government allowed. And here in Britain, for example, the British people elected somebody called Boris Johnson 4 years ago, and he's just been booted out of Parliament. Well, he's resigned, but he's just been sanctioned by the Parliament itself. So the people that the people want, we've seen the same, of course, with Trump in the United States being indicted. Those that the people vote for are then thrown out. And I'm afraid, I've got bad news for our friend, that's not democracy, is it?
Well, Andre, if we look at the situation with Ukraine, now Ukraine is saying that even with the cancellation of the agreement, it will continue to export wheat and other grains. Your thought on this and how dangerous possibly that this is, because the Russians now are saying actually that they can target these ships. So where are we going with this? When I talked earlier about the situation continually seeming that it is deteriorating, this is another example. Your perspective.
I remember how this grain deal came to be. We had Turkey as a third party invite both Ukraine and Russia to discuss with the United Nations. Again, this is not a deal between the two of them. The United States is not party to the deal, other than the fact then that it is a member of the United Nations. And this was a deal with the Secretary General of the United Nations in trying to make sure that, as I mentioned before, many countries in the Middle East, North Africa, South Asia, receiving their grain, as well as you mentioned at the beginning of this broadcast, it's the price of grain altogether. So when this large amount of grain, this second largest producer in the world of many grain products, is taken off the market, the prices rise dramatically throughout the world, and that leads to impoverishment as well. So when we have this deal and one party to the deal decides to stop what it was doing, which was allowing passage of ships through individual lanes in the Black Sea. The Black Sea has been mined next to the ports that are still active in Ukraine. Again, many of these silos still with grain from over a year ago because the process of distributing has been so long. And frankly, it is only through the sea that we can distribute all this grain. It'll take much longer through the rail process. That's something that Ukraine and Europe have been working on in terms of increasing that, but it's never been shipped out directly from Ukraine by rail, and therefore the infrastructure simply isn't there to distribute it. So hopefully, as you mentioned, Ukraine will continue doing what it's doing, and Ukraine's allies will make sure that grain comes out, even though the aggressor state to Ukraine's north, the one that has committed genocide, the one that continues breaking international agreements, even though that one threatens to dramatically give an increase in prices for grain around the world and possibly destabilize parts of the world. I think the rest of the world, as those 140 and 150 at the last vote, nations at the United Nations condemned what was happening. And that includes nations of the Global South, including principalities like Swaziland, including even observer states at the UN. The majority of small ocean states, all of them voted to condemn what was happening by Russia in Ukraine. So we really hope that a resolution is at hand and that global grain prices can drop back down where they're more manageable for these countries.
Well, Tony, your take, where do you see this going? Because according to what Andres just said, he said that Ukraine's friends will help them basically make sure the grains, the ships basically can get out of port. Does that mean more direct conflict with these NATO nations and Russia? And in general, where do you see all of this going?
Well, look, I mean, it's all very well to have NATO and Swaziland on one side, but what's happening on the other side is much more interesting, I think, which is the BRICS countries all getting together and creating a gold-backed currency, which is actually trying to create a firm and reliable economic system in the West. They have completely failed in their economies. There's been so much greed and nepotism and cliquey behavior at the top in the United States, Europe, and Britain that what's happening is their economies are collapsing. They simply cannot, because of all the cost of living is so high, rents and food so expensive, that they actually can't afford to manufacture anything anymore and make it competitive on the international market. So they're collapsing economically. Meanwhile, the BRICS countries are getting together and saying, let's have a really solid currency because the dollar is falling apart. The IMF is seen to be far too political. And so those other countries on the other side of this divide are actually looking well ahead and trying to create a stable world for the future. In the meantime, of course, you've got the conflict that's going on between the ruling classes, the elites in the West and in the NATO countries, not only with Russia right now in Ukraine and NATO, but also with their own population. I mean, we've got all these strikes going on in the UK, the public services, people in nursing, in teaching, all these in such important professions. People are just leaving because the pay is so low. They can't afford to pay the rent. They can't afford to pay the mortgage. They can't afford to buy food for their children. So what's happened is the elite in the West is now at war, not only with Russia, but with their own people. And they don't really know what to do, only to solidify their own clique and to try and fight this battle on those two different fronts. And I think, honestly, the policies are unhinged and they need to sit down around the table right now and to start to make sensible agreements, as it seems like people like Ben Wallace in our government, the previous Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab, maybe even Boris Johnson, who knows, to sit down and come up with a much better policy when it comes to our next general election with some kind of peace agreement with the Russians, and actually to stop this war, because the direction that they're going down seems very, very... They couldn't find anybody to replace Stoltenberg at NATO, could they? Nobody else wants to do the job because they can see it all heading for World War III. And there are hundreds of millions of people in Europe and the United States that simply are not going to accept that.
And on that note, I thank both of you being with me on this spotlight. Andrei Dobrynsky, Communications Director, Ukrainian Congress Committee of America out of New York. Tony Goslin, historian, investigative journalist, and former BBC employee out of Bristol. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and all the crew right here in Tehran. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
In the limelight.
German economy minister Robert Habeck says Berlin has no secure scenario for what will happen once Ukraine's transit contract expires. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted Germany will have to scale back or even shut down its industrial capacity if deliveries of Russian natural gas through Ukraine stop next year. Economy Minister Robert Habeck warned recently. There is no secure scenario for how things will turn out, Habeck said at the Ostdeutsches OWF, an economic conference in Bad Sarrow. Policymakers in Berlin need to avoid making the same mistake again by assuming that energy shortages would not affect the economy, he added, as cited by Bloomberg. Russia continues to abide by a gas delivery contract and pay Ukraine transit fees. However, given the current circumstances, it is extremely unlikely the agreement will be renewed once it expires towards the end of 2024. While Berlin claimed to have completely forgone Russian gas imports as of January, other EU countries still rely on Moscow for their energy needs. If Austria, Slovakia, Italy, and Hungary end up being cut off, the EU's gas-sharing rules would require Germany to come to their aid, which would create problems for industrial users, Habeck explained. The minister argued that it was essential to build new liquefied natural gas LNG terminals on the Baltic coast, which would enable Berlin to import gas from the US and the West Asia region. Local residents and environmental groups have sought to block the construction. Germany developed a business model that was largely based on dependence on cheap Russian gas, Habeck told reporters last August, arguing that this also created a dependence on the enemy of international law and liberal democracy. That model had failed and it is not coming back, he claimed. 5 weeks later, the Nord Stream pipeline supplying Russian natural gas to Germany were damaged in a series of underwater explosions. American journalist Seymour Hersh has accused the United States of ordering and carrying out the sabotage, while Washington and its allies have tried to blame Moscow or speculate about pro-Ukrainian groups that might have conducted the operation with or without Kiev's official blessing. According to Reuters, an energy crisis in Europe's biggest economy is not yet over, the head of Germany's energy regulator told the Funke Media Group recently, adding, however, that he expected gas storage tanks to be full by late summer. Klaus Müller said much had been achieved in a short time last year to diversify supply and reduce Germany's dependence on Russian gas after Moscow Ukraine crisis. When it comes to storage tank filling, we are now at a different level to last year, but the biggest factor remains the weather, said Mueller, adding the energy crisis is not over yet. He urged consumers to adapt their homes to save energy by installing insulation or more efficient heating systems. NPR had earlier reported, it's a great time to be a candle maker in Germany. Stefan Tammen, technical director of the European Candle Manufacturers Association, said, candle demand is very strong in Germany right now. The candle boom began during the pandemic after the government imposed lockdowns and Germans began spending a lot of time at home. The industry expected the boom to end once the nation opened back up, Tammen said, adding, but then the Russia-Ukraine crisis started. Prior to Russia-Ukraine crisis, Germany was getting more than half of its natural gas from Russia. It was Russia's biggest natural gas customer in the European Union, and many Germans used this gas to heat their homes, generate electricity and power their factories. But now, it's not the same.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.